session is Contragate, the real story, or who does Oliver North really work for? And my name, again, is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and I want to say to you as we start that I am really thrilled that this many people are here. And I say that for two reasons. One is, having lived and worked in Central America, particularly Nicaragua, I know how important this issue is to the lives of the people who are living in Central America, to the Central Americans themselves. And secondly, I believe, and I may be wrong, but I believe that unless we deal with the issue that we're going to talk about today, that we are on the road to dictatorship within our own country. That's what the stakes are in terms of this network that we're going to talk about today. To get started, just for in a brainstorm format, I'd like people to throw out, what are the names that are familiar to you now? What are the names that are coming up in relation to the Contragate, the Irangate kind of scandal? What are the common names we've been hearing? Let's just throw some out.
Oliver North.
Secord. Poindexter. Von Hall. William Casey. Again? Okay. Singlob? Ronald Reagan. Okay. We're going to see a lot of those familiar names are going to come up in today's presentation. Let me tell you, for those of you who are interested, I'm going to flip around. And I realize this isn't very big, so you may want to look at this afterwards or something, but I tried to diagram a little bit the secret team that has been operating and running U.S. foreign policy in and outside, according to the lawsuit I'm going to tell you about, since 1960. And I'm going to give you a history of their activities from trying to destabilize Cuba in 1960 on, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam, to Chile, back to Vietnam, Iran, and now more recently Central America, specifically Nicaragua. All the information that I'll be providing you is available in the suit that I'll tell you about that is being brought within the federal court system of the United States, naming 29 defendants as a part of this secret team. I will tell you before I start that there have been two very significant victories for the people who are bringing this suit, which is a way of saying it's going to be incredible, I think, at least it is for me, some of the things I'm going to be telling you. But there have been two significant victories, one of those within our country, one of them outside. In Costa Rica, the people who are bringing this suit won a major case. Some of the actors involved in this accused them of libel. And I'll be talking more about Costa Rica. And in Costa Rica, to be accused of libel, you are presumed guilty. And it's a federal offense, and you have to be able to prove yourselves innocent. And they were able to do that. That's one sign that a lot of this information I'm going to share probably has some validity. Secondly, they won a major victory in a federal U.S. court in Miami that has now given the lawyers for the Christic Institute, and I'll tell you more about them in a minute, federal subpoena powers, which gives them essentially the same powers that Walsh has to do a special investigation into what is really lying behind. And you can bet that the people I'm going to tell you about, Secord, Singlob, all those people, they made a very strong case in Florida to have this dismissed as simply ridiculous, fantasy land, etc. And the federal judge said, no, there is enough evidence based on what you've presented that we're going to grant this group federal subpoena powers to really try to uncover what's going on. The reason that that is so important is I don't believe much is happening in Congress. The hearings have become a forum for the Contra supporters to build support for the next time around in September. The right people are being called before the congressional committees, but none of the right questions are being asked. None of the right issues are being probed. Congress is taking a very standoffish attitude, and you can probably understand why after I make the presentation. So, I want to be clear, this is not Jack Nelson Pallmeyer speaking. I am trying to summarize a very complicated series of connections that comes out in this suit. But I will tell you that this scenario matches many of my deepest suspicions that have been evolving over many years, and particularly during my time living in Central America. Okay, I can't promise you how long this is going to take. I've never given a presentation on this issue before. So I will tell you at the outset, we'll obviously be done within the hour, and I'm also willing just to sit here and talk if anybody wants to talk about this more, if that means going to the second dinner or something. So I can't promise you it's going to be... Oh, there's only one. All right, well then that's no problem. So anyway, that doesn't start till 5:15 though, right? Okay, so that gives us a few extra minutes, maybe. All right, a little background. The Christic Institute, which is the group that is bringing this federal suit that charges a conspiracy, is an interfaith center, primarily Catholic, for law and public policy. It filed this suit in May of 1986, before a lot of this stuff was breaking. In other words, they had the names of all these people and were making connections before many of us heard about the ContraGate scandal. They named in their suit the principal actors. And what they are accusing these people of is, quote, a criminal network responsible for thousands of assassinations worldwide, funded by massive drug smuggling and illegal arms shipments. Okay, that's their charge, and that's what they're setting out to prove. And that this is a conspiracy that involves U.S. government officials operating within the framework of the U.S. government, and when that's not convenient, U.S. government officials and others operating outside of the framework. It's a network that is inside and outside, inside and outside. That'll become clearer as I make the presentation. The suit that they filed is very interesting. It comes under the Racketeering, Influenced, and Corrupt Operations Statute called RICO. Basically, this is a strong drug enforcement law, and you'll understand why they can do that because of the drug connections that I'll be talking about. Okay, how did this suit come together? How could they possibly begin to uncover this network? I want to tell you about two tracks that led them to the conclusions that we'll be sharing. The first is the Christic Institute was involved in defending some of the sanctuary workers. You remember the sanctuary trials? We're all familiar with those, right? Okay, during those sanctuary trials, a Methodist minister called up the Christic Institute and said, we've just been approached by the FBI. And the FBI told us, don't have anything to do with sanctuary. Stay away from those Catholics, because what they're doing is they're bringing terrorists into the United States from Central America that are going to begin a terrorist war against military installations and water supplies in the United States. Well, the Christic Institute was very interested in this information, because obviously if that was the tact that was going to be taken against the sanctuary workers, then we were talking about something very serious. We're not just talking about people who were driving sanctuary, people who wanted sanctuary from Central America and having them in their cars. They were, in fact, according to this, supporting terrorists who were going to be attacking the United States. So they tried to find out more about where this information was coming from within the FBI and investigating it. In the meantime, they were contacted by a friendly journalist, someone that people at the Christic Institute knew, who heard about what we all know to be true now, a Contra training base in Florida. This was before that story broke, so they started to investigate that. How was a military base for the Contras operating inside of U.S. territory, and who was helping that? So they started to look into that. As part of their investigation, they came across people from within various governmental agencies who weren't very happy about some of the things that were going on within the administration. In other words, insiders who didn't like it starting to talk about their suspicions and what they knew was going on inside the U.S. government. One of the bits of information that they received was that on April 6, 1984, President Reagan issued National Security Directive number 52, secret directive that authorized a federal agency called the Federal Emergency Management Agency to undertake a secret nationwide exercise to test basically the readiness of the military to control the U.S. civilian population in the event of a U.S. military invasion of Central America. Okay, so it was a test to see if they can control the civilian population in the case that the U.S. would declare a state of domestic national emergency as we launched a military invasion of Central America. This directive allowed for a number of things. It allowed for the deputizing of all Department of Defense personnel, all National Guard personnel, all military personnel in the United States, which is illegal. It is illegal to have them involved in domestic control, but to get around that, if you deputized all of them, then you can get around that law. So that's what it allowed for. It also allowed or called for the creation of 10 military detention centers or concentration camps to be built at U.S. military bases that would hold up to 400,000 prisoners. And the 400,000 prisoners immediately that they were thinking of initially were that they were going to round up Central American refugees who are living in the United States illegally, because they were afraid that some of them might be sympathetic to their own peoples in the case that we invade Central America, right? But there's a strong suspicion that that's not the only people who were going to be housed there. That people like you and like me who would demonstrate in the event of an invasion that those camps were being prepared for us. So you might all want to learn Spanish, because we'll be doing a lot of intercultural work. It'll move the rainbow on the mountain, it'll be rainbow in the prison. Okay, it also allowed for, and this is very scary to me, given the history of in Central America, the United States training civilian death squads, this is what I think of. It may not be right to think of that, but that's what I think of, is it called for the training of new state defense forces, civilians, that were, as it turned out, were being drawn primarily from Soldier of Fortune. Do you know what that is? Soldier of Fortune, right-wing people, and people who had been kicked out of their National Guards because of their right-wing political tendencies. And in fact, the training was going on in three states. I think it was Louisiana, Florida, and Arkansas, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so it allowed for the training of special forces that were to take charge also of control of the civilian population after we invaded Central America. The Defense Department, under this directive, was authorized and in fact did provide weapons for training exercises among these civilian forces that were being trained in those three states. And interestingly enough, through a not too complicated system, what they were doing is the Defense Department would provide the military hardware, but they would revalue that military hardware at the end of the exercises so that half of it would go back to the Department of Defense and half of it would be sent from Florida to El Salvador to the Ilopango Air Base that maybe you've heard about. That's the base that Hassan Fuss was operating out of. Remember the guy who was shot down in Nicaragua? Okay, was sending the rest of those weapons flying from Florida to El Salvador to the ranch of John Hull. His name will come up again, who is a large dual citizen in Costa Rica. He has a huge ranches right on the border with Nicaragua. He's also a U.S. citizen, and we'll hear more about that, okay? Now, one of the things that made people mad within this department that was carrying out this FEMA, I called it, let's see, what does that stand for again, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, was that most of the people working in FEMA were excluded from knowledge of any of this. And that's why when some of them began to find out, and they didn't like it, they started to leak this stuff to the Christic Institute. Okay, who headed this? This is very interesting. Who headed this effort, this FEMA effort? A guy, his name is Louis Guiufida, who likes to be referred to as Comandant Louis Guiufida. And he carried out a similar exercise, guess where? In the state of California in the 1960s called Project Cable Splicer, which was a war game state of martial law exercise ordered by then Governor Ronald Reagan and Special Assistant Attorney General Edwin Meese. Okay. Same track. The journalist kept digging into the military base in Florida, talked to people and find out that there was a major effort going on in Honduras through a program called the Civilian Military Assistance Organization. So he went to Tegucigalpa in January of 1984, went to the place where a meeting was to be taking place, and saw all these soldier of fortune types at a meeting who were very eager to talk about what they were doing. And they were there to recruit, train, finance, supply, and launch a foreign military force to invade Nicaragua, using former U.S. troops, using former National Guards people, and using anti-communist Cubans, which are key in this whole thing, I'll come back to them, and anti-communist or Nicaraguans who had left Nicaragua. One of those people was a man I mentioned yesterday named Thomas Posey. And Posey, unbelievably, he loved to talk about this stuff. So he kept feeding information to the journalists. And he talked about all these unlawful activities. He bragged about the terrorism and how all this was being done to terrorize the civilians in Central America. And he also led them to the White House, because what he indicated was that who he was meeting with was Robert Owen. And Robert Owen, as you'll remember, is key to this, because he was Oliver North's direct contact with the Contras. And in Posey's words, he would meet with Owen, and then Owen would go back to North, and they would take the military orders and make sure that whatever military orders these Contra forces needed, that they would get. Okay. Now, track two. This is part, a lot of the information for this is coming out to the Christic Institute through this process, through that sanctuary lead. But something else happened. How many of you have heard of the La Panca bombing? Okay, not too many of you. It was a bombing that took place right across the Costa Rican border into Nicaragua in May of 1984. And the occasion of that bombing was that a man named Eden Pastora, who was a Nicaraguan, who was dissatisfied with the Nicaraguan Revolution, decided to take up arms. And we could talk about why he did that. I know something about Eden Pastora. But he refused to join the largest Contra group, which is called the FDN, because he said that they were essentially a former band of Somoza, the former dictator in Nicaragua, Somoza killers, former National Guards people, and completely under the control and domination of the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, Pastora didn't like the Nicaraguan government, but he didn't want to give up his independence and join a group that he saw as being totally opposed to the interests of the Nicaraguan people, in his view. Okay, so in May of 1984, Eden Pastora has a press conference in which he is denouncing the largest Contra group, the FDN, denouncing the Central Intelligence Agency for all its atrocities, for trying to manipulate him, etc., etc. What happens? The journalists come to have a meeting in this very remote spot. One of those journalists claims to be from, Denmark, a Dutch journalist. He claims to be a Dutch journalist, walks into the press conference, sets his a camera case down. Then, as the press conference starts, he kind of fumbles with his camera and says, oh, geez, my camera's not working. Walks outside. Fortunately, someone came in to hand Eden Pastora a cup of coffee and tipped this thing over accidentally with her foot. The thing, within minutes, there's a huge explosion. 28 people are mutilated. 8 people are killed. Pastora is injured but not killed. Several U.S. journalists are seriously injured, including one U.S. journalist who was killed, right? One of the journalists who was injured is a man named Tony Avergan. And he and his wife, who's also a journalist, her name is Martha Honey, decided to try to investigate who planted the bomb. The CIA, initially, and the U.S. government issued a report right away that the Sandinistas planted a bomb trying to kill Eden Pastora to get rid of one of their enemies. Right? Okay, so that was one story. But what did Tony Avergan and Martha Honey come up with? And this is what they had to defend in Costa Rica, and they won their suit. What they found out is that the journalist was not a Dutch journalist, but was a former or present member of the Chilean secret police. And by the way, under Pinochet, you know about the Pinochet dictatorship. By the way, that secret police has been trained by a U.S. group in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, that is continuing to function today. It trained the Shah of Iran secret police. It trained the Chilean secret police. And this guy, his real name was Amak Gahil. And he had left the bomb at the conference under contract with the Central Intelligence Agency, with Secord, with a lot of these people who are part of the secret team. And I'll come back to that. They discovered that the explosives that were used were C4 explosives. I'm not an explosives expert, but what people say about C4 explosives is it's the explosive that is second in power only to nuclear. And it's basically only available through intelligence networks, particularly U.S. intelligence networks. What they uncovered is that the Central Intelligence Agency, working out of John Hall's ranch, again, the Costa Rica ranch, with Adolfo Calero, you know who he is, he's the principal Contra leader that the U.S. is holding up as the freedom fighter for democracy, right? That they planned and helped carry out, and I'll come back to that, this assassination attempt. Now, what they also found out through a defector who was involved in this planning was that the same group of people, the CIA, John Howell, all these folks, were planning the assassination of the U.S. ambassador in Costa Rica. And his name was Louis Thomas. Why did they want to assassinate him? Because they wanted a pretext through which the United States could either invade Nicaragua or blame it on the Sandinistas as a pretext for deepening the war. But there was another reason as well, that the two most powerful drug kings, I'll say kings, they're both men, in Colombia, where Toms was previously, Ambassador Toms, now in Costa Rica, was previously in Colombia, had tried to do something about the drug trafficking that was moving from Colombia into the United States. So they put $1 million, said, we'll fund the Contras for $1 million if you kill Louis Toms, and it will work out very nicely because then you can use it as a pretext to invade Nicaragua. Sounds like a nice plan. So they uncovered this, the assassination or potential assassination of the U.S. ambassador in Costa Rica. All right. What they also discovered, Honey and Avergan, these two journalists, was that the same flight paths that were being used to fly the weapons from Florida to El Salvador, then to the ranch, John Hall's ranch, what they would do is they would unload the weapons, right? And then they would turn around, fill up the same planes with cocaine coming from the Colombia, same flight path back into the United States, and they were funding the Contra operations, enriching themselves through running cocaine into the United States. Again, This is with approval of elements of the CIA and with the operations of this secret team. Okay. They also uncovered that the C4 explosives that were brought in for the assassination attempt against Pastora and that were to be used to blow up the U.S. Embassy in Costa Rica were smuggled in through the combined efforts of Theodore Shackley, his name, you're going to see it a lot, Thomas Kleins, Richard Secord, Albert Hakim, it's another key name in all this, Thomas Posey, who's the guy I mentioned earlier, John Hall, and a Cuban, very important name, it'll come up a lot, Rafael Chichi Quintero. Okay. Now, just before I go on, a summary of some of the key observations at this point. One, we've got the involvement of a number of Cuban exiles in the assassination effort of Pastora, in the creation of, the idea was to create a southern front against the Nicaraguan government operating from Costa Rica, operating out of John Hall's ranch, involved in the drug trafficking and the arms shipment. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Second, the CIA links. There are a lot of CIA links here. I'll tell you more about Shackley and Kleins, our CIA agents that have been in the CIA for a long time. They finally were left in 1978, and I'll tell you why. Okay, so you got Shackley and Kleins, you've got a lot of CIA involvement here. Third thing to keep in mind, that a lot of money is flowing into various kinds of assassination efforts and the funding of Contra forces via illegal drug running and via illegal arms shipments. It's important to think about that. Fourth, there is direct involvement of the White House via, at this point, via Robert Owen and Oliver North through the National Security Council. And then fifth, just to look at involvement of the White House in terms of these secret national security directives that I talked about earlier. Okay, well, because some of these things we'll come back to. Now, for me, all of that is frightening enough and interestingly enough, but we haven't even gotten to the tip of the iceberg yet. And here's where we got to start talking about the secret team. Where are the roots? And this, the secret team, that's the Christic Institute's term. Where are the roots of the secret team? They begin in Cuba in 1960. What happened in Cuba in 1959? Batista's ousted, Fidel Castro comes into power, you have a revolution, and one of the immediate things that the revolution did in Cuba was it kicked out the drug dealers. Some of the most powerful drug dealers in the world. All right? Where do they come? Where did the Nicaraguan drug dealers come? It's a city, Miami. And that's where they came. So you have, in 1959, the beginning of the formation of a group and program called Operation 40. Operation 40 was started, this is hilarious to me on one level, by Vice President Richard Nixon. So we get back, we're going to be linking Nixon and Reagan here in interesting ways. Vice President Richard Nixon establishes a special committee of the National Security Council to destabilize, that has the task of destabilizing, overthrowing, and assassinating Castro in Cuba. Within Operation 40, Nixon forms a secret right-wing network of Cubans, Cuban exiles, that are supposed to launch attacks against Cuba. But within the framework of Operation 40 starts a private subgroup or sub-operation that has the specific task of political assassinations in Cuba, of the Castro brothers, of Che Guevara, and of others. So there, this is an assassination hit team within Operation 40. Okay. Two key actors in the forming of this committee and the assassination team is Richard Nixon and this guy named Traficante, who was the largest drug dealer in Cuba, who was forced out with the Cuban Revolution. Two other names to keep in mind in Operation 40, Rafael Chichi Quintero, I've already mentioned him, and a guy named Eric von Marbod. Their names will come up again. Also involved in the formation of this were two billionaires, Howard Hughes and E. Howard Hunt. They were some of the principal financiers of this whole operation. Okay. Now, it's very interesting. The Cubans who made up this initial assassination team formed in 1960s. Here's some continuity for you. They were found in the Watergate Hotel and were part of the Watergate break-in. They were coordinators and pilots for the operation in which Hassenfuss was shot down. Same network. Remember Hassenfuss shot down in Nicaragua. They were involved in the training of assassination teams throughout Southeast Asia. And I'll come back to that period of the history. And in the case of Chichi Quintero, he was responsible for forming the Southern Front using John Hall's ranch. He was responsible for building the air bases. He was responsible for coordinating the drug trafficking and the arms shipments. So many of the same people involved in the 1960 operation are involved in the secret team all the way through, but particularly in the Central American aspect now in Nicaragua. Okay, just for your information, Kennedy, when he won the presidency, was briefed on Operation 40, the destabilization effort, but apparently knew nothing about the secret assassination team, as far as can be told. And Operation 40 became the great failed adventure of the Bay of Pigs operation, when the U.S. tried to launch this invasion of Cuba using Cuban exiles, and it failed miserably in April of '61. So when the Bay of Pigs operation failed, It was regrouped into an operation in 19, operation called Operation and Operation Mongoose took place basically between 1961 and 1963. So the Bay of Pigs has failed. The desire to assassinate Castro is still there. So you change things a little bit. And who is in charge of Operation Mongoose? Theodore Shackley and his assistant Kleins. So they run Operation Mongoose from 1961 to 1963. And part of the way they funded their operation was through drug running through Traficante, the big drug dealer, now operating out of Miami. Okay, Kennedy is assassinated in 1963. If you want to ask a question about this, I don't know a whole lot about it, but there's a lot of speculation that the secret team had John Kennedy assassinated. It's another big question mark. Okay. We know all kinds of efforts were made to assassinate Castro. All kinds of efforts were made to destabilize Cuba. The operation failed. Finally, Operation Mongoose is canceled in 1965. So in 1965, what's beginning to heat up? The Vietnam War. So Shackley is transferred and becomes the deputy chief of station for the Central Intelligence Agency in Laos. Transferred with him, Thomas Kleins, again, the deputy chief of, he's immediately under Shackley. So they're in Laos together. What do? In Laos, they start using U.S. air support in a drug war. And they eliminate, and in fact assassinate, two of the major drug competitors to a man named Von Pau. Von Pau now becomes the largest and wealthiest opium dealer, running opium into the United States through, guess who, Traficante. They set up their drug network. So, with the profits, now they're, keep in mind, these people, Kleins and Shackley, are operating within the CIA, that they're using the drug profits, the reason they did that, to get Von Pau in power, was Von Pau is funneling millions and millions and millions of dollars into their efforts to build an assassination team in Indochina, made up primarily of Hmong tribesmen. So they trained the Hmong tribesmen in political assassinations under the direction of Kleins and Shackley. They used their positions and funds in the opium profit for this training of these assassination team. Also in 1966, there's a special program formed called the Special Operations Group that was set up in Saigon but was still supervised by the same people, Kleins and Shackley. They carried this out from 1966 to 1968. Some interesting connections. Who supervised the operation in Saigon? General John Singlob. You've all heard of Singlob in terms of the Contragate affair. Today he's the president of the World Anti-Communist League, and he became the leading fundraiser in the private Contra aid network. Serving under Singlob in this capacity and carrying out from Saigon was, guess who, Oliver North. The deputy air wing commander for this special operations group for the Air Force was Richard Secord. A member of the Army Special Forces Unit in the special operations group was Dwight Owen, brother of Robert Owen. Between 1966 and 1975, under this program, funded with money from the CIA and with money from the Von Pau drug operations, the Shackley, Kleins, Singlob, Secord, Owen, North network assassinated more than 100,000 civilians in Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand. Mostly civilian mayors, bookkeepers, clerks, and bureaucrats that were suspected of leftist tendencies. In 1968, Theodore Shackley's partner in Operation 40, Santo Traficante, again teams up with Von Pau, and he becomes the largest dealer in white China heroin into the U.S. 1972, Shackley and Kleins transferred to the United States, actually, where they coordinated, they became the deputy directors of the Western Hemispheric Operations Office of the Central Intelligence Agency. And they oversaw the program known as Track 2, which was the destabilization of the Allende government, the democratically elected socialist government in Chile. Shackley and Klein and their crew. Okay. By September 1973, Allende is assassinated and Pinochet comes to power. 1974-1975, Vietnam and the U.S. again. Shackley, Klein, von Powers, Secord, a new actor Armitage, and the old actor from the Cuba days, von Marbod. And in 1974-1975, a couple of key things began to happen. One, they carried out the Phoenix Program. People remember what the Phoenix Program was? It was a program to assassinate, they figured they assassinated more than 60,000, again, non-Viet Cong mayors, bookkeepers, etc. And what was happening, apparently, is that these people, Shackley and Quines and the others, saw that the handwriting was on the wall. The U.S. was about to lose the war, and the idea was to try to destroy as much of Vietnam's capacity to survive after the war as possible. Gets back to my point yesterday, those of you who heard my talk on low-intensity conflict, destruction as a definition of victory. This is what they were doing through the Phoenix Program. So they were funding that Phoenix Program again through the money of von Powell, also operating through the Central Intelligence Agency. Their liaison officer between the Nixon White House and the Phoenix Program was Nixon's old friend, Eric von Marburg. He was coordinating that. And who was he directly responsible to? Henry Kissinger. In 1973, Shackley and Clines began to see again that the war is losing, and so what they decide to do is form their own private, outside of the CIA, their own private anti-communist assassination and unconventional warfare program to be carried on after the U.S. pullout. So in 1973 and 75, von Powell is providing all the money, or most of the money, for the assassination program in Vietnam called the Phoenix Program. But what they're doing, what Shackley and Klein's are doing, is they're overcharging. And they're getting all kinds of money, and they're using some of that money for the assassination program, and they're funneling the other money into an Australian bank. And the people who carry the money out are Secord and Klein's, carrying millions of dollars out by hand and funneling them into Australian banks. At the same time, as you know, Vietnam was a rather large war. What Klein's and Shackley did is they took hundreds of tons of weapons and had them shipped to Thailand for storage to be used in their own private wars later on. And in fact, they have been used in that way. So the money and arms were available for use by Shackley, Klein's, Secord, and a new actor in this, a guy named Richard Armitage, becomes important. He was the U.S. Navy official based out of Saigon. So, where do they go from Vietnam? They go to Iran. Shackley and Klein send Armitage to Iran to set up a secret team covert operation outside of the U.S. government. This is now their operation based on their commitment against what they call communism, right? So it's a non-CIA backed. They're still working for the CIA. But they are now taking it upon themselves to do this dirty work. Okay. They also sent, oh, I know what happened. Armitage, who is also working for the U.S. government, gets fired because he wasn't doing any of the work that he was supposed to do. Right? But, so they fire him, and he starts a company called the Far East Trading Company, which really was the front group that was funneling the opium from Indochina into the United States. 1975, Richard Secord is transferred to Iran to assist in the private assassination efforts. Again, he is an official part of the U.S. government and gets put in charge, and this is very important, of the Middle East Division for the Defense Department, basically being in charge of all arms sales to the Middle East. That's Richard Secor. Okay, who's his superior? Erich von Marbach. Again, Nixon's old ally from the early 60s on. So what does he do? Secor, in his position, doesn't allow direct nation-to-nation sales. He says that all sales going to the Middle East have to be channeled through a private company. Who's the private company? It's their own company. It's headed up by Hakim. Again, very familiar name to us in terms of these. So what they do is Hakim buys the weapons from the U.S. government at the manufactured price, but sells them at an enormous profit. And the profit, they pay the U.S. government the manufactured price, and with the profits, it goes into the same Australian banks to fund the secret team's assassination programs. Okay. Beginning 1976 through 1979, Secor, Shackley, Kleins, Armitage, Hakim, and their new partner, Wilson, set up a whole bunch of dummy corporations that are basically to mask the drug operations and mask their arms operations through which they're raising their money. One of the significant ones was called the Egyptian American Transport and Services Corporation. Sounds good, right? Basically what that is a gun running operation. Okay, now we get to Nicaragua. In 1978, Shackley, Kleins, Secord, Hakim send their new partner, Edwin Wilson, who's now a full partner in the secret team, to Nicaragua. What was happening in 1978 in Nicaragua? An insurrection. They're getting close to the ouster of the Somoza dictatorship. So they go there and they propose to Somoza that they will set up a private assassination team to start bumping off opposition leaders, and particularly to assassinate the Sandinista leadership. So this gets all arranged, set up. The Cubans are involved, the same Cubans who were involved in the training into China and the Cuban operation, same Cubans involved in Operation 40 and that assassination team within it. Set this all up, but Somoza decides that the price tag is too high. Probably, if you were around today, you probably would regret that decision. So the contract doesn't get signed. But then in 1979, what happens? The Carter administration decides to cut off military assistance to Somoza because of Somoza's human rights violation. So Carter cuts off the assistance. Shackley, Kleins, Secord, Hakim, and the secret team then go to Somoza and say, we'll supply you with weapons. Okay, keep in mind, these people are still operating out of the CIA. The CIA has said, under the direction of Stanfield Turner, says, no more arms to Somoza. No more support to Somoza. Carter says, no more support to Somoza. And here these guys are operating from within the CIA. They just operate within their own network and start providing arms to the Somoza dictatorship after the U.S. officially cuts off the arms. Okay. In late 78 and 79, Turner finally asked for the resignation of Shackley and Kleins because their partner Wilson, in the arms transfer deals, gets caught shipping arms to Gaddafi in Libya. So Wilson is today in jail. Okay? And in order to avoid, you know, a major stir about all this, Turner says, through Frank Carlucci. You know who Frank Carlucci is? Frank Carlucci has now been appointed, what, the National Security Advisor, right? So it's Frank Carlucci. He doesn't want all this to come out, so he arranges a deal and says, we won't say anything about all your assassinations. We won't say anything about all the stuff you've been doing. Just ease your way out quietly. So they're eased out quietly, but obviously they continue to do their work, right? July 17, 1979, what happens? Somoza's overthrown. Somoza leaves the country. He goes to the Bahamas, and almost as soon as he arrives in the Bahamas, he's met by the secret team. And they say, you've got your National Guard, the remnants of your National Guard. We'll start funding you. We'll create the Contras. So immediately, the secret team starts the process of creating what today are the U.S.-backed Contras. It's a secret, covert war, almost identical to the same war that Shackley and Kleins organized against the Cuban government back in the early 1960s. And one of the key advisors and negotiators in all this was Chinchi Quintero, as well as some of the other original Cubans. So they start providing money to the Contras until June of 1981. What happens? President Reagan comes into power. So President Reagan, George Bush, Ed Meese, Casey, all those people get together, Oliver North, they get together with the secret team, and they say, thanks a lot, guys, but now we'll take it back. You got the Contras going, good job, good work, but now we're going to put control of that in the CIA. And you may remember that Reagan approves $19 million to start destabilizing the Nicaraguan government. Okay, what happens in late 1983? Congress is getting a little restless. You have all the stories of Contra abuses. Just doesn't seem to be going very well. The CIA has been caught illegally mining the Nicaraguan harbors. The CIA has been caught producing an assassination manual of how to get rid of leaders in Nicaragua. So Congress passes the Boland Amendment. So what happens? President Reagan, Bush, Ed Meese, William Casey, McFarland, Poindexter, North meet, and they decide that it's time to contract the secret team. And so they do. They contract the secret team, and the secret team, Shackley, Clines, Hakim, Secord, and all those guys reactivate their military supplies for the Contras. And Rafael Chichi Quintero is put in charge of most of that supply, all the way back to the days of Cuba. All right, so by March 84, the secret team has become the major suppliers to the Contras, including the explosives that were used in the La Panca bombing, and including developing the plans to try to assassinate Louis Toms. All right. Now, should be fairly clear within the framework of all this that when the United States decided that it wanted to sell arms to Iran in exchange for hostages, who do you go to? You go to the experts. You go to the secret team. And so the idea is, again, not a new idea, it's the old idea, that you can skim the profits off the top of those in order to fund your operations. And so that's exactly what happened. Secord's involved in purchasing planes for the Contras. Rafael Chichi Quintero is building the airstrips again, smuggling weapons and drugs. Hakim, Secord, and Clines are all part of a group called Stanford Technologies. That's one of their companies. And one of the things that came out when the Hassenfuss thing broke is that the safe house that Hassenfuss and the others stayed in El Salvador got daily phone calls from Stanford Technologies. What a coincidence. So the secret team supervises the weapons shipments from Florida to El Salvador to John Hall's ranch. Now, I'm going to bring this to a close. I managed to stay within the hour, but I wanna just highlight a couple of more things, and then we'll open it up for discussion about what this means. Why did the United States decide to sell arms to Iran? What's the official reason given? The hostages. But why did President Reagan not care anything about the hostages for years? Why did that suddenly become an issue? Go ahead.
Because the hostage they were concerned about was the CIA offered them.
That's right. You may remember that they didn't get concerned about the hostages until a man named William Buckley came up. William Buckley, we said after he was kidnapped, we said, he's a private businessman. Then later on, the U.S. government admitted, no, he was the deputy station chief of the CIA. That's not what William Buckley was. William Buckley was the worldwide head for the Central Intelligence Agency of their quote-unquote anti-terrorist operation. Now, anti-terrorist, in terms of the secret team, is a code word for assassination team. And what the Christic Institute says is that William Buckley was not killed in Beirut. William Buckley was taken to Iran and was tortured to death in Iran on tape. That helps answer the question, why did the United States send 40 semi-loads full of weapons to Iran after they knew that William Buckley was dead? Because the Iranians are holding the United States hostage. Because William Buckley basically laid out probably not only this picture, but probably a whole lot of other unpleasantries about the activities of the Central Intelligence Agency. Second kind of interesting connection. Robert Owen, again, Oliver North's kind of run man to the Contras, and of course North is operating directly now from the White House. He hires a public relations firm called Gray and Company, and that's the firm that Singlov got put in charge of to raise private funds for the Contras. Two interesting things about that. The Christic Institute says, first of all that private fundraising effort, very visible up front, was meant as a smokescreen. In other words, the amount of money that was raised through that effort really isn't all that significant, but it was meant to mask the hundreds of millions of dollars that were going to the Contras through the CIA still, and through the drug operations and other illegal operations. But here's the real kicker for me. Guess who is the vice president of this PR firm, Gray and Company, which is Robert Owen's company, hired Singlov to do the private fundraising? John Tower. So you can imagine how interested John Tower is in getting this story out, right? Okay, third point. It's very important to understand that this secret team has operated both in and outside of the U.S. government, carrying out quote-unquote acceptable U.S. governmental policies, but also subverting the U.S. Congress and president in those few moments when we've had any rationality in terms of foreign policy. They just operated on their own. Okay, fourth observation is that the charges of the Christic Institute are literally, and this is very, very important, they're Reagan, Bush, Meese, Casey, McFarland, Poindexter, Owen, North, sat down, decided all of this, and consciously made contracts, consciously retook over the war, 1981, then with the Boland Amendment, consciously hired these guys to carry out the policy. This is not a case of a president not knowing what's going on. It's not a case of a president who's saying, oh, geez, I give a lot of freedom to my people and I don't know what's happening. They're in it up to their eyeballs. And then the fifth comment is that where I started this, and this is where the Christic Institute people see, if anybody wants to see, I have a two-hour tape in which someone much more articulate than I am gives a two-hour presentation on this. And he says, do you know what we're hearing now? What we're hearing now is how the U.S. democracy can't afford another Watergate. How the U.S. democracy can't stand up to the truth of this. How we've got to try to keep this covered up because the American people can't handle it. And what the Christic Institute says, and what I agree with, is the people who are saying that have never believed in democracy. They've never believed in democracy. They've never had faith in the U.S. people. They've been subverting it for 25 or 27 years, and now they're the ones who are going to tell us we can't bring this out. And what the Christic Institute says, more or less, and I'll say this for myself too, if we don't cut this cancer out, which is a cancer right in the balls of the U.S. government, then we're not going... First of all, this cracks open a lot of the illusion of democracy that we've been living with. But secondly, if we don't take it out, the future does not bode very well. And the last thing I'll say is an appeal to all of you in these times that right now it's very important to put pressure on your congresspeople and the congresspeople who are involved in these hearings to start getting at some of these real issues. Because if it doesn't happen, then our only hope is in the federal courts. But let me tell you, one of the things that's already started happening is one of the key witnesses for the Christic Institute has been assassinated. I can't stress to you my own belief and the Christic Institute's belief that the thing, what's at stake here, is really pretty incredible. Okay, that's my effort to summarize this, and I hope in a somewhat intelligible way. Yeah.
Documentation on all of this. Incredible amount of information. It doesn't mean anything if it isn't. I mean, what I
Okay, the documentation, what you'll find some documentation in here, which is their suit that they filed in the federal court. Now, where this suit is at in the federal courts is, by being granted federal subpoena power, the next step for them is to get sworn affidavits from all of their witnesses, from all the people who have provided this testimony that allows them to piece this picture together. So it's precisely that documented stage in the evidence that is going on in the suit. That's where the suit is, and it takes a long time for them to do that in a meticulous fashion. So that's the evidence that they have pieced together. They've got the witnesses, they've got the connections, but now they've got to get those people to be willing to do sworn affidavits. That's the process. Now there's one other danger here, and the danger is that a lot of these people who are talking and have talked to them are risking their lives and their careers. And some of them are saying, we don't know if we want to talk officially unless we're given immunity for our participation in these things. So there's a whole process that's going on, but that's what the stage is right now, is to get all the people to swear to the truth of what they are, back that up with other witnesses, etc. That's what's happening. Yeah?
I'm trying to remember the provisions of the RICO. I'm familiar with the financial side of it, but not this type of application. If it's brought by the government, it can be a criminal action. If it's brought by a private party or organization, is it merely a civil action and a cease and desist situation, or you know?
I've got a sheet of paper that describes exactly that. If you want to see it, I'll be glad to show it to you at some point. I don't have that in my head. What I do know is that they are bringing it under that act. A private citizen who has had their livelihood or their business hurt can bring suit. In this case, it's Tony Avergan, the journalist who was almost blown up to death in the Lapenka bombing, who survived it. But the way the act reads is that they can bring suit. It's a $17 million, and it's a criminal suit. It is a criminal suit. But the way it reads is, this is the power of this RICO Act, is that you not only can prosecute the people who put the bomb down, you can prosecute the people who are part of the ongoing conspiracy. That's why they're able to name initially 29 people instead of a few.
Well, it has to be that way to be under RICO, because it has to be a pattern of action over a period of time before it's come under that law.
But if you want to see the specific description of how it fits under RICO, I've got a one-page sheet from the Christic Institute on that.
Question?
Yeah.
You mentioned real high-powered people in our country ramrodding this deal. Who's above them? Or do they know? Is there anybody above them? So there's financial people to mention too.
I don't know if there's anybody beyond them, but I think what you see is you see, one, a very, very reactionary, ideological position that unites a lot of these people together. That includes organized crime, it includes drug traffickers, it includes the Reagan administration, it includes a whole lot of people. So you have that as a bind. And then obviously behind that, in the case of one of the things that happened in Chile, for example, was part of this track two strategy of the destabilization of Allende was carried out through AT&T, through Anaconda Copper. So I'm sure that those connections exist all the way through. And obviously the arms dealers are tied in. So there's a lot of connections that tie these people together. But what's in a way, it's not unique exactly, but what makes it somewhat unique with the Reagan administration, well, although it started with Nixon too, is the concrete decision to contract with these guys. You know, once it became clear. And the other, it's hard for me to read, you know, based on what I know and based on what I've read in this affidavit, it's hard for me to know just how much of their activities, for example, in Laos and Cambodia were going on through an actual planned strategy of the Central Intelligence Agency, and how much of it was them, because they had both things going at the same time. They had their official status and they had their unofficial programs. So I think it was probably a combination of those things being woven together. Yeah, and then I'll go here.
Okay, two quick questions. What's the administration, basically, what is their rebuttal to this, or what has been the rebuttal? And number two, what role, what part in this does Southern Air Transport...